Tonight on Arena, Declan Burke and Sam Blake with something old and something new to read over the festive season. And Sophie Gorman on the life and times of Graham Greene. Well, we're definitely at that point now where we might start to think about what we want to read over the Christmas period, something gripping to sink into an armchair with during the festivities. So we thought we'd ask two crime enthusiasts to choose a classic crime novel and something newer and perhaps a bit out there as suggestions for your reading over the coming days. I'm joined by writers Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin, or as she is known by crime lovers, Sam Blake, and by Arena's own crime buffin, Declan Burke. I just love the two classics that you've both chosen. One, The King of Hard-Boiled Private Detectives, Philip Marlowe, the creation of Raymond Chandler, of course. And the other, the most evil and genius of all perfect, in inverted commas, crimes, Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith. And let's start with the classic ones, because people, I think, will be familiar with these. And there's something lovely about familiarity, I think, around the Christmas period. We all want a bit of that. We'll start with Raymond Chandler. Before we get into Philip Marlowe, of course, we have to claim some bit of him as our own. There is an Irish connection here, Declan.
Raymond Chandler is Waterford's finest, Sean, and there's a lovely plaque in Waterford to commemorate the fact he had, as a young man, he was born in England, moved to the States and went back to England to be educated. But in the interim, he had spent a short period of time in Waterford. I haven't seen the plaque, but my wife was kind enough to text me a picture of it last summer.
Yep. So you've double checked it. The evidence is there. And the novel that you've chosen for us is, in fact, Chandler's first novel, The Big Sleep. And this was his graduation from the Pulp Magazine School of Writing. What did he learn there? Was he coming from a very odd place to the writer he became?
Well, he was an oil man. I mean, that was his profession. The Great Depression took hold and he had to find another way to earn a living. The pulp magazines paid quite well back then. Excuse me. Black Mask, I think, was the first one he was published in, probably the most famous. And they were looking for short, hard-boiled stories, to the point, very much no messing around. Chandler's own advice to other writers, you know, if in doubt, have a man come through the door with a gun in his hand. Very typical of the kind of stories he would have written. And very much in the milieu of Dashiell Hammett, who was writing his Continental Op stories at the time. They were private eye stories, and the Sam Spade novel, The Maltese Falcon, which came out in 1929. The Big Sleep then came out in 1939. So you might wonder why we're not talking about The Maltese Falcon, but we're instead talking about The Big Sleep.
It's the one that you've chosen, and that's fair enough. You mentioned hard-boiled there. Just to define that term for me, because we always bandy it around, I think. Yeah,
there's a couple of reasons why people started using that phrase. Chandler himself said about Dashiell Hammett that he took murder out of the drawing room and dropped it back in the alleyway where it belonged. So what we have is the idea of a crime mystery novel in which murder generally took place, but they took place in the milieu in which they actually took place. So we're not talking about Agatha Christie's country houses and so forth. But it was also to do with the language, of course. James M. Cain was another classic example of the hard-boiled style. Very spare, very stripped back, very little by way of literary flourishes, we might describe it that way. I would argue, and will argue, that Raymond Chandler was a much more literary writer than he was given credit for at the time. But it was very much about forceful narrative, you know, as I said, paring back the language and driving the story on.
Okay, you're going to argue very positively about Chandler, and I'll let you do that when the time comes. But there are a couple of problems now with Mr. Raymond Chandler in some of his attitudes, it has to be said.
Is it Mr. Raymond Chandler or Mr. Philip Marlowe that we have the issue with? Certainly reading it now, and I reread The Big Sleep last week. And you know, the attitudes of Marlowe towards anyone who wasn't a white Anglo-Saxon, basically. You know, women, gays, Mexican characters, all of them are treated very, very harshly, very negatively, very pejorative terms used. And there's quite a lot. There's at least three different women who get slapped around. You'll slap it and you'll take it and you'll like it, as Humphrey Bogart says in one of the classic noirs. So, yeah, very problematic now when we read it now. was very much of his time. Was Chandler a misogynist, as many people have argued in the past? I'm not sure. He certainly makes his character, Philip Marlowe, not a very likable hero, but he is supposed to be a tough man who's earning a living in a very tough place.
But you're kind of letting him off on the grounds that it's Marlowe that's the misogynist. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I am. I don't know enough about Raymond Chandler to say otherwise.
You've mentioned Humphrey Bogart, so we kind of have to go there, really, don't we? And The Big Sleep, the Howard Hawks film from 1946. Just give us the basic setup here, because we're about to hear something very early on in the film, which is probably some parallels to the plot in the novel.
Well, we're introduced to Philip Marlowe, who's a private detective. It's Los Angeles. It's the 1930s. And he's calling on General Sternwood, who is a millionaire who was commissioning to investigate something. We're not sure yet what, but we're introduced to this fabulous mansion. General Sternwood wants Philip Marlowe to investigate a blackmail scenario that's been woven around his younger daughter. The older daughter, Vivian Sternwood, when Marlowe emerges from this meeting, then requests his presence for a consultation.
And we shall listen to that request right now. Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall.
You wanted to see me?
So you're a private detective? I didn't know they existed except in books, or else they were greasy little men snooping around hotel corridors. Ah, you're a mess, aren't you?
I'm not very tall, either. Next time I'll come on stilts, wear a white tie and carry a tennis racket.
I doubt if even that would help. Now, this business of Dad's, think you can handle it for him?
It shouldn't be too tough.
Really? I would have thought a case like that took a little effort.
Not too much.
What will your first step be?
The usual one.
I didn't know there was a usual one.
Oh, sure there is. It comes complete with diagrams on page 47 of How to Be a Detective in 10 Easy Lessons, Correspondence School textbook, and your father offered me a drink.
You must have read another one, How to Be a Comedian.
Hear what I said about the drink?
I'm quite serious, Mr. Marlowe. My father's
not...
Help yourself. Now, look, Mr. Marlowe. My father's not well, and I want this case handled with the least possible worry to him.
That's just the way I was going to handle it.
I see. No professional secrets.
No.
I thought you wanted a drink.
I changed my mind.
You know, I don't see what there is to be cagey about, Mr. Marlowe. And I don't like your manners.
Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me.
People don't talk to me like that.
Oh.
There you go, Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart from The Big Sleep, the Howard Hawks 1946 movie. And we're talking this evening, Declan Burke is with me, as is Sam Blake, choosing for us two classic, a classic crime novel each, and a newer novel, crime novel each as well. And the first one we've been speaking about is The Big Sleep. I find it impossible to think about Raymond Chandler and not think of Bogart, even though he had created the Sam Spade character that Dashiell Hammett had there as well, didn't he?
Yes, indeed, Sean. Very similar iconography between the Sam Spade character and the Philip Marlowe character as portrayed by Humphrey Bogart, you know, the fedora, the trench coat and so forth, and the sardonic quips. We've just heard a lot of that, you know, very similar kind of characters. Possibly Sam Spade in the novels. Sam Spade is a much more cynical character, even though Philip Marlowe is cynical himself.
And it also brings up the point that it wasn't Chandler who invented the private eye detective. That was, in fact, Hammett, wasn't it? Dashiell Hammett.
Absolutely. And Raymond Chandler always gave Dashiell Hammett the credit for inventing the subgenre. I think Dashiell Hammett, you know, some people argue Dashiell Hammett got there first, and so therefore he should have all the credit for, you know, the hard-boiled private eye genre. Some people argue Ross McDonald, I know many people who do, who think he kind of completed the ideal of the romantic private eye, fictional private eye. I prefer the Raymond Chandler version. I think it's the Goldilocks version. He's not quite as hard-boiled as the Dashiell Hammett one. He's not quite as sophisticated and urbane as Lou Archer, who is Ross McDonald's character. He is rude, he is crude, but there's a kind of crude poetry as well to Philip Marlowe that, you know, he's rough enough for the world in which he lives without being too crude or too rough.
But what about the whip-smart dialogue, the likes of what we got in that clip? Is that all over the novel as well?
Oh, it's absolutely saturated. And it's one of the reasons why I fell in love with The Big Sleep when I first read it. In fact, I had never realised you were allowed to write like that before. I was about 21 when I read it, and it blew the proverbial socks off. You could write about a very serious subject in a very serious way, but you could also have this mordant black humour, which I didn't realize at the time, but is very typical of real life, how real life policemen, for example, would deal with a murder scene and so forth. But some of the lines are just, you know, in the first paragraph of The Big Sleep, we get Chandler telling, or Marlowe telling us that I was neat, clean, shaved and sober, and I didn't care who knew it. That kind of thing is all through all seven novels. In Farewell, My Lovely, which is my favorite Chandler line, there's a line, it was a blonde to make a bishop kick a hole in a stale glass window. I mean, that kind of thing. If that kind of thing beeps your Jeep, then you will absolutely adore the Raymond Chandler novels.
Yeah, I suppose just before we go to Sam's choice, let's take one more clip from the film. And this gives us an idea of the attitude to the law. We listen to the attitude to the whole legal process and to the police department. This is another clip featuring again Bacall and Bogart, and it kind of explains themselves.
May I use your phone, Mr. Marlowe? Hello? Police headquarters, please. Hello, this is Mrs.
Hello, what do you want, please? What? I called you. Say, who is this? Sergeant Riley. Well, there isn't any Sergeant Riley here. Wait a minute, you better talk to my mother.
Hello, who's this? The police? Well, this isn't a police station. Well, if you know it, then why did you... Look, this is not a police station. What was that you said? Oh, my father should hear this.
Hello, who is this?
This is the police talking.
Yeah, but she just told you that... Oh, you're the police. Oh, he's the police. Oh, well, that's different. What can I do for you? I can do what? Where? Oh, no, I wouldn't like that. Neither would my daughter. I hope the sergeant never traces that call.
You like to play games, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Do you know, as I listen to Bogart and Bacall there from The Big Sleep, Declan Burke, it's almost like an Abbott and Costello or a Three Stooges type of patter, the way they do that, although there's obviously the dark undertones there as well.
There is, but the play may be more for the humour in the movies than they do in the actual novels, but having said that and talking about the film of The Big Sleep, which Raymond Chandler adapted himself, there's a fabulous smouldering chemistry between Bogart and Bacall, which makes that kind of, you know, relationship very, very plausible.
Yeah, well, the chemistry was there in real life as well, and so true, I guess they managed to keep it on screen. All right, that's the first of our suggestions for you, The Big Sleep, Raymond Chandler, Declan Burke offering that to us. Sam Blake, let's go to your classic choice now, Sam. And again, we're in a world where we're talking about films and books. This is astonishingly the debut novel from Patricia Highsmith, Strangers on a Train.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a really lovely link actually to Raymond Chandler and to Declan's book there, because when she sold the rights to Hitchcock, she didn't actually realise that it was Hitchcock who'd bought them for the rights, the film rights to the book. And he tried to persuade many people to write the screenplay, and one of those people was Raymond Chandler. But in fact, they fell out. So the eventual screenplay was written by three women, one of whom was Hitchcock's wife, to actually bring the movie to the screen, so to speak. So nice connection.
Yeah, but he didn't pay her well, did he, really, Hitchcock, when it came to Patricia Highsmith?
He didn't. $7,500 was all she got. She was disgusted, I think, when she found out who had actually bought it.
And very quick, the novel was written in 1950. The film came in 1951. So he obviously saw something in the novel the minute, or somebody said to him, you got to do something with this novel. What was so good about it as a novel?
I think it's that high concept. It's the fact that it's one of those things that I think when we talk about no-brainers, we talk about the thing that's so obvious but so brilliant that it's been captured. And the fact that these two guys meet on a train, they don't know each other, they're complete strangers, and they, inverted commas, form a pact to commit a murder. It's just the perfect premise, isn't it? And I think that's really what he saw and what he captured. Certainly in the movie.
And the two guys, just as because we're kind of chalk and cheese world here, aren't we, between Bruno and Guy Haines?
Absolutely. Guy Haines in the novel is an architect, so he's quite creative, and he's heading to a place called Metcalf to meet his soon-to-be, he hopes, ex-wife, Miriam, and a woman he really doesn't like very much because he's madly in love with Anne. And Bruno is really a playboy. His father won't release his sort of funds, but he's living living very, very comfortably, and he has no job and he's dropped out of university, and he's really, in terms of character, quite one of the most absolutely obnoxious characters you would ever meet in a novel. He really is ghastly, and so I think Highsmith captures him quite brilliantly, and that's part of the menace of the novel.
Yeah, and there are some changes made from novel to film. We'll put those to the one side for the time being, because in this clip from the Hitchcock film, you just get a sense of the dynamic between the two men and the basic setup of the novel as well as of the film. Bruno, played by Robert Walker, and Guy Haines, played by Farley Granger. A little proposal has Bruno.
Want to hear one of my ideas for a perfect murder? You want to hear the busted light socket in the bathroom or the carbon monoxide in the garage?
Neither one. I may be old-fashioned, but I thought murder was against the law.
What is a life for two guys? Some people are better off dead. Like your wife and my father, for instance. Oh, that reminds me of a wonderful idea I had once. I used to put myself to sleep at night, figuring it out. Now, let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
It's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason.
Let's say.
Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Ah. Now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen. It's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
We're coming into my station.
For example, your wife, my father, crisscross.
Oh, what a suggestion that is from Robert Walker playing the part of Bruno and Farley Granger playing the part of Guy Haines, the two strangers that meet on the train. Incidentally, Sam Blake, you kind of took this basic concept yourself and moved it into a different realm, a more contemporary realm in your own book.
I did. In Keep Your Eyes on Me, I have two ladies who meet on a plane. I had quite a few situations where I travel a lot, and before, obviously, the current situation, and I met lots of very interesting people on planes, and I just thought it's really interesting what can happen. It's the sort of what if, and yeah, so definitely took a similar theme.
Hold on a minute. When you were on the plane, did you have this conversation with somebody else, or did you overhear the conversation between two people?
I didn't. I had a very interesting conversation with a lady who'd gone to the UK for a job interview, in fact, but not told anybody here that that's where she was. And she turned off her mobile phone and literally had the situation where when we parted at the Dublin airport and she was going off on a bus to another part of the country, I thought, if something happens to her, I am the only person who knows where she is. She's been for the entire weekend because she didn't tell anybody else. And that started me thinking.
Well, clearly it is. Well, let's go back to Patricia Highsmith then and Strangers on a Train. You know, a debut novel, as I said, in 1950. Did she come out of nowhere? How did she arrive in the scene so perfectly formed? Because the book picked up by Hitchcock, which possibly helped the book, but it was strong in itself before that.
It's a brilliant book. It's beautifully written. Yeah, no, she definitely come from sort of a literary background, and she'd been working. She went on a course. She knew Truman Capote, and she went on a course that was recommended by him. So she sort of come out of that scene. Her parents were artists. Although she came from a very, very troubled background, and I think that's what we see in these characters. Her parents separated before she was even born. And when she was six, she was yanked out of Fort Worth in Texas, where she was brought up, moved to New York. And then when she was 12, she was sent back to her grandmother for a year, which she found really, really traumatic. So I think she had a very troubled background. And Declan was talking there about Raymond Chandler Marlowe being quite an unpleasant character, and certainly when you read the biographies and look at the diaries of Patricia Highsmith, I think she was quite troubled from that respect too.
Yeah, and Bruno in the film and in the book has a kind of a mother obsession, there's a problem with his relationship with his mother. Is that a direct parallel to Highsmith herself?
I think so. I think there's definitely a theme of obsession in all the way through, and it becomes sort of clear. It's like an undercurrent that Bruno's actually quite obsessed with Guy Haynes too. And I think that reflects, very much on Patricia Highsmith's own life and her troubled relationship with her mother, who never wanted her at all and made it very clear that she didn't want a child. And I think that difficulty was definitely something that was reflected in all her books throughout her life.
In fact, her biographer, Andrew Wilson, went so far as to say that he saw similarities between Highsmith's life and that of Sylvia Plath.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he said, she very much drew on her diaries. This is sort of his quote. She wrote in his biography, it was called Beautiful Shadow. Mm. She drew on the diaries for her novels, which explore the notion of obsession, guilt and murder. But she really was, and this is how Wilson describes her, monstrous, violent and quite an unpleasant woman. She hated black people, she hated Jews and she hated women. But there's also reasons why she was like that. And I think absolutely it stems back to her very troubled past.
Of course, most people, when you hear Patricia Highsmith, with the name Tom Ripley will come to mind, and
absolutely,
the talented Mr. Ripley, obviously the more recent film versions. But there have been several film versions of it, and indeed of Strangers on a Train. Does her promise as a novelist, is it there from the very first book? And, you know, what is the quality of that book that makes it so good?
I think it is, absolutely. I think it's her characters. I think she manages to create characters that you can relate to and you can find parts of yourself in, no matter how awful they might be. And her settings are beautiful. She's a fantastic writer. I mean, really, for a debut novel, it's just quite incredible, Strangers on the Train. The settings, you can see everything. And as I say, Bruno is this incredibly obnoxious person, and you read it just purely to see what's going to happen. I mean, it grips you.
Always nicer to read about obnoxious people than deal with them.
Indeed.
Or speak to them or be in the same room as them. Okay, Declan, I suppose the character side of thing, I know you're a Highsmith fan yourself. Yeah, but the character side of things, that's there in your modern choice, if you like, Tana French, who comes from an acting background. And I think that's quite interesting in terms of her writing of character. Just she ever again arrived on the scene with a big splash.
Oh, made a huge splash within the woods. For a number of reasons, I think. First, she's maybe her acting background plays a huge part in her ability to inhabit her characters. Certainly, they all seem quite psychologically true to the universe that she has created for them. Also true that on a line-by-line basis, she's a beautiful writer, you know, beautiful style to her. But I think it's the slightly offbeat characters that she creates. She has a reputation of being a psychological writer, the writer of psychological thrillers, and it's fully deserved. I think within The Woods, there was a very ambiguous ending, shall we say. It was highly unusual. I won't say too much if anyone hasn't read it, but highly unusual ending for a conventional crime thriller. And there was a bit of an uproar out of it. Mm. And as a result, Tana French got a lot of publicity, fully deserved.
Yeah, and I suppose that was the kind of the basis in the Woods was more what we got in terms of Dublin Murders on the BBC RTE series. That was kind of similar. That was that story that we're being told,
yes,
with a little bit extra thrown in.
Yeah, that is correct. And I think they did a very nice job of bringing Tana French's work to the screen. I'm not sure if TV or even film can provide the same kind of psychological depth as the novel can.
And let's be clear, you're saying In the Woods was a great starting point for her, but the book that you're suggesting is the read for over the Christmas period is Broken Harbour.
Is Broken Harbour, which I think, and In the Woods, I should say, it was multi-award winning, a hugely decorated novel for a debut novel, but I think Broken Harbour is her masterpiece. She has just published The Searcher, by the way, which is her finest book since, but Broken Harbour was published shortly after the Celtic Tiger crash, and I think it was a very important novel and possibly the best novel to have captured that economic crash. It revolves around a character called Scorcher Kennedy, who had been a minor character in a previous novel of hers, and this is a bit of a trick that Tana French pulls off. She takes a minor character from a novel and makes them the main character or the protagonist in a subsequent novel. Scorcher Kennedy is a detective, and we find out why. He is a man who really, really needs to play by the rules. This makes him a terrific detective. Mm. Not a lot of great faith in his judgment, in his in his flights of fancy and so forth. If everybody obeys the rules, including Scorcher Kennedy, then the job will get done and the truth will come out. Now, that's Scorcher's approach to being a detective. Things do not go to plan. Unsurprisingly, he goes to investigate a particularly horrific crime in a ghost estate called Broken Harbour. And there he discovers a man has apparently, he's committed suicide, his two young children have been smothered and his wife has barely survived a knife attack. Now, it looks pretty obvious to, you know, most people what has happened. And Scorcher believes, if you read the room, it's obvious what has happened here. Now, questions are raised, there are strange holes in the walls and so forth. But effectively, what Tana French is doing here is creating a novel of psychological trauma that is directly influenced by the economic
crash.
And
it is that idea of, you know, her investigators often come to whatever they're investigating with a backstory that either clouds their judgment or helps their judgment. Is that, which is the case, would you say, with Scorcher?
I would say both, actually. And in fact, the problem with Scorcher Kennedy, And this is different to the main character in The Woods, who had a self-described cracked personality. Scorcher Kennedy is probably a little too clear-eyed in his view. If it quacks like a duck, etc., then it must be a duck. And Scorcher finds himself unable to look beyond the immediate evidence and start teasing out the kind of psychological nuances, which is what his partner, who is a minor character in this one, which is what his partner wants him to do and nudges him to do and so forth. Now, I really don't want to give away too much about the plot, and that's the first 20 pages or so of the plot that we're talking about here.
What I would say about that, you know, wanting that if it's a duck, it quacks like a duck. In some ways, was Tana French making a comment there? Because I know she spoke to you around the time of this about the Celtic Tiger and how it was people who played by the rules ended up paying the price.
This is absolutely a theme that's teased out throughout the novel because, as you say, Sean, you know, during the Celtic Tiger, we were all told, you know, get on the property ladder, do the right thing, you owe to yourself, you owe to your children, etc., etc. Yeah. And if you play ball with the banks, then the banks will play ball with you and the economy will keep growing, you know, ad infinitum. And, you know, this family, the Spain family, as I say, are obviously a family who got caught on the wrong side of that with tragic consequences.
All right. Broken Harbour, then, your suggestion if we're looking for something of a more contemporary nature to read over the Christmas period, Declan. Let's go to your second choice then, Sam Blake. And this is Catherine Ryan Howard's The Nothing Man.
It is indeed. And it's another high concept book, another story that we can talk about very quickly. It's really a book within a book. And it's about a serial killer who is reading a book that is written by his almost last victim. So it's a really, really, really clever concept.
Yeah. And are we dealing with something close to true crime here?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's a true crime book within a fictional book, but a fictional true crime book, if you like. But it was very much based on the Golden State Killer, Joseph James D'Angelo. And Catherine was reading a book came out called I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which is about this incredible case that had gone on for years and years and years and years in California. And it wasn't until 2 years later that this man was caught, and Catherine was starting to think about it, and she thought, wouldn't it be amazing if the killer, the Golden State Killer, had read the book about himself? And that's really what The Nothing Man is about. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Jim Doyle is a security guard, and the person who's written the book is Eve, who survived an attack, shall we say.
That title, The Nothing Man, you know, they say, how do you write about nothing? Because that's kind of what she's giving us, the idea of this character who gives nothing away, who is nothing, who seems like the most benign creature in the world.
Absolutely. And certainly in terms of the crimes themselves, he's the guy that they couldn't catch because he sort of whistled in and whistled out again and seemed to have a very good knowledge of forensics and all of these types of things. And so he was invisible as far as the the police were concerned at the time. But he becomes much more than the Nothing Man by the end of the book.
And what about you, Declan? You've read this as well. What do you feel about The Nothing Man?
I totally agree with Sam. Catherine Ryan Howard is by some distance the most innovative of the Irish crime fiction writers, and the serial killer novel is maybe the most hackneyed subgenre out there in crime fiction, and she has taken it on here and completely reinvented it and given it a whole new fresh spin. It's very, very impressive.
All right, well, that's four great books to get sorted. Happy Christmas to both of you. Hope you have a great time, and I'm sure you'll be reading other books. But in the meantime, Declan Burke and Sam Blake, the four books that they've suggested to us are The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler, Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith. They're the two classics. And in the more contemporary vein, Broken Harbour by Tana French and The Nothing Man by Catherine Ryan Howard. Declan's book is called The Lammisters. Sam Blake's most recent book is called Keep Your Eyes on Me. That, in fact, is the one that deals with the same kind of story as the Patricia Highsmith. And the one that's due out soon, we're told, is The Dark Room. Looking forward to all of that enormously.